Unconditional love sets the stage again. It hits the reset button for people. And in our experience, I think it's very clear that if you give people a well-intentioned and sincere opportunity to set their lives right, they'll take it.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
So it's great to welcome along today Michael Haller and Byron Johnson. Michael is a professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of North Florida, as well as a senior research fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. He won an award for his book, Private Prisons in America, A Critical Race Perspective. Byron Johnson is Distinguished Professor of the Social Sciences at Baylor University. He's the founding director of the Baylor Institute for Studies of Religion, as well as director of the Program on Pro-Social Behavior. He's a leading authority on the scientific study of religion, the efficacy of faith-based organizations, and criminal justice. And Byron is the author of more than 250 articles and a number of books. Byron is also project director for the Global Flourishing Study, an initiative which will include data collection for approximately 240,000 participants from 22 geographically and culturally diverse countries. They've co-authored the Angola Prison Seminary, and this year they co-authored the Restorative Prison. They kindly sent me copies of these books in preparation for this podcast, both of which I found to be really interesting, thought-provoking reads. I really enjoyed them, and thanks very much for those. I want to emphasise that although we're talking about religion today, there's a lot of really rich material in both these books that is relevant to all practitioners working within the criminal justice system, no matter what your spiritual beliefs. And I'm sure that even those who don't themselves identify as religious will hear some really valuable insights in this conversation today. So welcome to you both.
Thanks, Naomi.
Thank you.
Hi, Byron and Michael, really good to meet with you today. Perhaps we could start by you describing how you each came to be combining the study of religion with criminology. Perhaps, Byron, you could begin.
Sure. Well, I was raised as a very religious person. And so from the outset, when I began graduate school, I thought I would love to be able to study these two interests that I have, one in religion and one in criminology. And I thought combining the two might be a great idea. Interestingly enough, my professors thought it was a terrible idea. Why would anyone want to study religion? And I remember saying, well, because there's nothing on the subject. And if you review the textbooks in criminology, you'll find nothing on religion. And yet it's so pervasive, at least in America. And so they said, well, I guess that's a good enough reason. If there's not a literature out there, they finally green-lighted that. And that was 30 years ago. And now there is a significant literature that does look at the connection between these two interesting topics. So it's been well worth the investment of time over the last few decades.
That sounds like a very interesting pathway there, Byron. How about you, Michael?
Well, I would say my interest in religion starts with a personal connection to faith. As a child, I was actually in a tumultuous period of our lives as children. I was thrown out of public school and put into a Catholic school. And I always, part of my testimony, as most prisoners would put it, is my experience of being cared for by the Benedictine nuns when I was in about second grade. And so even though as an adolescent and young college student, I stepped away from faith, shall we say, later in life, I came back to it. And I had always relied upon a sort of deep religious sentiment in terms of trying to reconcile the contradictory forces pulling at me in my life. And I often found great solace in the practice of my faith as a Catholic, and still do. Now, if you ask me what it means to be a Catholic, I can't answer that, because if you look at the Catholic Church today and organized religion today, it's experiencing, you know, lots of fissures and divisions, which frankly, I believe are healthy. and that we can talk about later play out in interesting ways in the context of prison. And also sort of demonstrate how prisoners, practitioners, you might say, have an entirely different religion, relationship to religion than the commentariat upon religion. So we can explore that further, but that's briefly my story.
Thank you. And you don't have to ask this question, but I was wondering why you were thrown out of public school.
Misbehavior. Yeah, I was acting out. Well, it was a tumultuous time. My parents were, you know, teenagers when I was born, and not to belabor my history, but I found myself in Catholic school, and just one of my most vivid memories is being taken by the hand by a particular nun who sort of looked out for me and to go to chapel. And I've shared this with Byron. It was really in my memory, the first time I could really exhale in my life where I had some space enough to just kind of start to process. And so just on a visceral kind of personal level, frankly, that is also what I see in prisons. And we have, with Byron's, you know, leadership, we have been working in some of the most difficult, challenging, dangerous, largest prisons in the world. And I feel and see and hear some of that same emotionality that I felt as a child. That's how I'd have to put it.
Thank you. Thank you for being so honest in that answer. The reason I asked the question was because it's been fairly frequent in these conversations, particularly with men, that we've found out that, you know, the person has had a really troubled early life, particularly at school, but eventually found some place that tapped into their, some place or some person that tapped into their kind of creative side. And from that point on, they began to flourish. So it's interesting to hear, you know, a similar kind of pattern being described by yourself. So do we know anything, do you think, about how many people practice a religion prior to their incarceration as against afterwards?
Well, you know, let me kind of go first on this one. This is a fascinating question that you've asked, because as Michael will share too, we've had the privilege of interviewing hundreds and hundreds of prisoners over the years. And one of the things that I've always been just struck by is the high percentage of prisoners that would say, you know, I was raised in the church. You know, my mom used to drag me to church. And so, especially for prisoners that return to faith while they're incarcerated, it's not a new thing. It is something that they can reflect upon. And the story is very similar. Yeah, I was raised in church. And then when I became a teenager and could begin to make decisions on my own, I broke away from the church and went a different path, a much darker path. And that led me to this destination. And so for many, they wind up in prison and, you know, they're trying to figure out, what do I do with my life from here? And there are so many of these faith-based programs in prisons that many of them think, maybe I should revisit the faith of my youth. And so for so many, it's a return to something that they were exposed to many years earlier. And in America, of course, I think America is still an unusual place in many ways, in that so many people in America claim to be religious. About 95% say they believe in God. In spite of all that you hear about how secular we are, about 4% of Americans are atheist. And that's remained unchanged for 70 years. So religion is pervasive. And so a lot of prisoners, your listeners might think that, you know, they would be anything but religious, but for many of them, they have a history They've forsaken that history, and now they come back to it. The question that you asked, it's really difficult post-incarceration, because we do a very poor job of staying in touch with prisoners post-release. It's just difficult to do. And I know Michael and I have had a bit of success tracking down some of these folks post-release. And is it difficult for them to remain a practicing person of faith on the outside versus inside? And this becomes very interesting because many of them can't replicate what they find behind bars, believe it or not. And so on the outside, it's a struggle to fit into a faith community. I remember hearing one man talk. He was not your typical offender. He was a physician and a Wall Street mogul. So an unusual person, goes to prison, finds God in prison, comes out of prison, and completely struggles because the brotherhood is missing. So this is a upper class white individual who can't find a congregation. And so you can imagine how difficult it would be for a person of color, for example, who finds God in prison, and then they get out. Here's an upper class white individual that could not replicate what they experienced in prison. So he began reaching out to people that he knew had come out of prison so they could at least assemble together. And Michael's has been studying up close and personal a congregation in his backyard of ex-offenders who've had that same issue.
Yeah, let me just add, I would say just real quickly with regard to prior faith, I mean, lots of prisoners say, yeah, my parents dragged me to church. But even more frequently, they will say, well, I went to church as a child, but I came to faith in prison. And there's a difference there. And I would say that, you know, there are no atheists in foxholes, as they say, and the context matters. It's certainly the case that, and Shad Maroon has done a great job, and others have as well, of documenting how the context of prison imposes a kind of negative stigmatizing self-narrative on people that religion helps them work their way through. And that is arguably the formation of a conversion narrative does the work of helping men and women who come to faith, as they put it, reorganize their lives and adopt a new identity. And so the other thing I'll say just quickly is that, and I've interviewed hundreds of prisoners, self-defined religious prisoners in maximum security prisons, and you would be stunned how frequently the narratives are almost identical. Across prison, across security level, across race, where in conversing with them about their religion, they share with us that this is the first time anyone has given them what Carl Rogers describes as unconditional positive regard. Because the context of faith, unconditional love, sets the stage again. It hits the reset button for people. And in our experience, I think it's very clear that if you give people a well-intentioned and sincere opportunity to set their lives right, they'll take it. And it seems to me that's the attraction of faith-based programs. That's the energy behind faith-based programs. In the midst of a system that is absolutely destroying people, by the way, in the midst of a prison system that is utterly inhumane, abusive, violent, undignified. The first thing we argued about Angola was, borrowing on Alison Liebling's phrase, that, and she's informed all of our work, a lot of her perspective has, that religious programming improves the moral performance of the prison, meaning that religious programming enhances the ability of the prison to treat prisoners with some level of dignity. And it's a level of dignity that they define for themselves, not that's imposed upon them. Contrary to the argument that lots of people like to try to make about religion in prison, Prisoners don't appreciate religious gaslighting, and they will stand up in your face and tell you so. So I can tell you with real certainty that if a prisoner is participating in a religious program in prison, especially a maximum security prison, they're doing it of their own free will. And it is truly a voluntary kind of program option for them. Now, are they perfect? No. Do they need to be monitored? Absolutely. Are they for everyone? No. But again, in the midst of a prison system that Alison Liebling calls a failed state prison system, right, where you've got an environment that is inherently violent and abusive to people such that it makes them worse rather than better. Religious programming, particularly religious volunteers coming in from the outside, enhances transparency of the prison. It enhances social capital of the prison and prisoners. Okay. And again, like Shad Maruna so thoroughly documented, and others, Peggy Giordano, she calls religion a toolkit. It provides the building blocks for someone to reconceptualize their entire life and the opportunity to do that very difficult work on themselves, which is sadly otherwise missing in the American prison system.
You touch on something really important there, Michael. I think for context, and David spent a lot of time working in therapeutic communities in British prisons and hospitals, and the service that I was clinical director for also tried to, it wasn't a therapeutic community, but there were community elements, and nothing more striking than sitting in a group with men who've been there for three, who are in their 40s, saying this is the first time in my life I've ever felt loved. And that seems to be what you're getting at with that sense of being embraced within a religious community. And obviously therapeutic opportunities in prison are much more limited, whereas everyone in prison does have the ability to be embraced in religion, in a religious faith community, if they wish to choose that, by the sound of things. So I think you're highlighting something about the impoverishment of what has been available for people in their lives outside of, if they're having to be in a prison in order to feel that there is a unconditional positive regard for them or love or whatever else wants to be incorporated within that. But that's pretty sad state of affairs, isn't it? When you think about the proportion of our societies where that is their experience.
No doubt.
Totally agree. With that, Naomi, I think this is why visitation, for example, is a powerful variable. Inmates that receive visits are less likely to be rearrested. These are people that tend to be forgotten by large swaths of our population, and that's why. Again, one of the things that we find fascinating is who visits the prisoner. And it tends to be people of faith, much more so than people that would consider themselves of no faith or would consider themselves, secular in their orientation. Why is that that people of faith are more likely to visit the prisoner? And for many of them, they would say that they're called to do so, that Matthew 25 suggests that prisoners should not be forgotten. And so that's why they do it out of a compulsion. For many people that I've talked to, it's kind of like, this is hard work. I'm doing this after I get off of work during the day to visit prisoners at night or whatever. So just something that simple as visitation means a lot. And so one of the things that, when Michael was talking about the sad state of affairs, when you think about our prisons, and you can argue it's getting worse because as the economy struggles, programs get cut. And so some of these prisons, the last remaining programs are run by faith-based volunteers. And, your listeners may think that they all come in with Bibles, but a lot of these volunteers come in and teach inmates how to read. They teach them how to do math.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we find very interesting is that, again, maybe counterintuitive here, that these faith-based approaches are really holistic. That they don't come in and see these people as people that just need to be ministered to. They see them as people that have physical needs, emotional needs, and spiritual needs. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we have seen, and Michael and I have tried to help criminologists to understand this, and that is that if we really care about the least of these among us, why wouldn't we care about their spiritual lives if that is by definition a big part of their life? And I think that that criminologists have done a terrible job. This is why religion's overlooked. So many of them are not religious. They don't think it's important, not realizing that for many people, it is an important thing. And so I think that these ministries are quite holistic in their orientation. And, you know, I think that too is a response to a calling that many have told us that they have on their lives. The last thing they thought they would be doing is spending time in prisons, but they do. And guess what? The volunteers also tell us that they are the beneficiaries, not the people that they go in to visit. That they themselves, their lives are transformed much more so than possibly the person that they're going in to visit. That too is a consistent story across prisons that we have heard that really is compelling in its own right.
Yeah. You know, here's another thing that's really getting in the way, I think, of an authentic study of religion in the social sciences, but in prison in particular. And that is that the sort of culture war debates we're having as in society about religion, and that, you know, the academic tendency to be dismissive of religion as something we've sort of abandoned, you know. It's stunning to me because religious volunteers are maybe the only source in many cases of real progressive reform of the sort that leftist academics say they want, except if it's brought into prison by religious volunteers. So, you know, what volunteers who just by virtue of coming in and being nice to someone, by showing unconditional positive regard to someone, as a result of being motivated by your faith, to do so, not because you view yourself as superior like most professors do, right? But because you view them as peers or siblings, brothers and sisters, right? So, you know, what that does is it introduces what we argue is that it introduces a kind of pro-social modeling into the prison that is otherwise absent, utterly absent, okay? It enhances the transparency of the prison. If you've got outside volunteers coming in, who can report back or who are going to hear from prisoners what's going on in the prison, believe me, that changes the prison, okay? That utterly changes the prison. And so, you know, the social capital dynamics of religious volunteerism in prison have been utterly ignored by criminology virtually, okay? And, you know, if we have one thing to say today, that's a starting place, okay? But then also this, Byron mentioned the cost issue. You know, I mean, we've got a lot of talk and conversation about abolitionism and this kind of thing. And listen, I'm not unsympathetic to that conversation. However, from my perspective, if you want to be realistic, an inch of progress is better than a mile of intention in prison. Okay? So we can have all these meaningful conversations about abolitionism, but if you want to improve the day-to-day lives and safety of prisoners, we need to focus on the here and now. We need to focus on what can be done face-to-face on a daily basis with the human beings who are suffering in the American and in the British. You know, I'm well aware of the kinds of things going on in Great Britain right now. And as Byron pointed out, if not us, who? You know, it's in the United States, at least, it is overwhelmingly disproportionately religiously motivated volunteers who would even consider going behind the gates of a prison to serve their fellow citizens, because it's scary. It's scary to do so. and it's inconvenient, and prisons are remotely located, and it gets expensive. And when volunteers bring things, reading materials and newspapers and, you know, just sport, the sports page, it doesn't have to be religious. Okay. When they offer that kind of engagement of themselves to fellow human beings who are incarcerated, I thought that was the point of criminology. Our highest aspirations for rehabilitation are to treat people with humanity and respect and some measure of dignity. Well, I think we stumbled on an example of it that's virtually ignored in the literature. So it's curious.
Well, it's, I mean, some of our best friends are criminologists, so we mustn't be too unkind to them. But what I think you're highlighting is a really interesting area for debate. And I haven't heard it voiced in the way that you're putting it this afternoon. So that's really fascinating. Maybe we'll go into that a bit more later on. But can I take you up on something else that you said earlier, which I found very interesting, because you described how a very large proportion of the population of the United States would have had religion in their households at an early age. And it sounded to me as if what you were describing was that for many, many people who end up in prison, religion is a kind of segment of their social infrastructure. So they may not have bought into the whole idea of religious faith, but when they get into prison, and I think this is what I heard you saying, somehow they connect with something which is familiar, and their faith may develop from that point on. Is that kind of how you see it?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, David, for sure. But at the same time, we've seen plenty of people that had no faith at all, and still find God or you know, have these conversion narratives while in prison. Because one of the things that happens is that for those people that do find God in prison, the last thing they're going to do is to keep it quiet. So there's a lot of what this expression of sharing the gospel. A lot of these inmates consider themselves ministers and missionaries. And so we've studied that group too. So it's not that the vast majority maybe are returning to something familiar. There are others. And you know, even people converting from maybe one religion to another, that too is a possibility where this new religion is not familiar at all. So, you know, one size doesn't fit all in terms of, you know, their previous exposure. But I do think there's a lot of this idea of how can I share a new meaning and purpose that I've never had before? How can I share that with others? And so we've seen a whole lot of that, especially in Angola, where they literally train inmates to become ministers, who basically give their lives away in service to others. So that to us was, you know, such a powerful thing, because we were able to spend literally years in one prison instead of spending several weeks or months doing a project, to camp out there and to see these people at all hours of the day and night, especially Michael, who just basically lived there for a while. I'm surprised they didn't give him his own cell. But you do get a chance to see people at all hours of the day and night and on the weekends, and you get a chance to know them. Especially in Angola, where almost all of these guys are serving life. I mean, that's the interesting thing. They're not getting out. They're going to die there. So really kind of compelling to see how something like finding meaning and purpose and hope for the first time that replaces that despair influences how they share their faith with others.
Yeah, let me add to that just briefly, if I could. I mean, you know, it's got to be said, Naomi, and I think you'd agree that sending fellow citizens into prisons that destroy them demeans us. It demeans us. Okay. And so, you know, Alison Liebling talks about heliotropism, right? That plants are attracted to light and they will grow toward the light. Well, that's the same thing we're trying to say. That's what positive criminology is. You know, I think another piece of the puzzle that we face in our discipline is the increasingly abandoned doctrine of deterrence, okay, as the focus of our enterprise. And it needs to be abandoned. Criminology from the deterrence perspective is a zombie discipline at this point, as far as I'm concerned. It's alive, it's dead but alive somehow, right? And positive criminology, what we're trying to espouse here is a strengths-based, desistance-focused paradigm that lifts people up rather than trying to punish the bad out of them, lift the good out of them, right? Because why? Because we have almost zero evidence that you can punish someone into good behavior, right? And probably the leading light of this conversation is Shad and Allison. You know, those two talking about this concept of desistance, right? Well, sadly, within 3 years, 70% of prisoners after release have been rearrested. And 5 years out, upwards to 82.3% have been rearrested. Over half are reincarcerated in the United States, okay? So the whole notion that you are deterring offending by punishment has been disproven over and over from the very beginning, frankly, okay? And so Shad and other people, lots of criminologists, Steve Farrell, a bunch of them, Farrington, lots of brilliant people have said, you know what, let's take a look at that 20% who succeed on parole. Let's take a look at those who don't reoffend and just talk, see what's going on there. That's called the desistance study, right? The Liverpool desistance study would be one you could look at. So, you know, when they started to talk to those few, that low percentage of offenders who do not reoffend, they learned something very powerfully interesting. That when they stop offending, it's not because they fear going back to prison. It's because something else happened. It's because their lives, to use a criminological term, started to become good lives. There's a good lives model. We were gonna talk about that maybe later, where they begin to be able, the minority, the strong minority, begin to be able to piece together a life that is enriching, that is meaningful, that gives them a sense of self and positive direction. Okay, all of which is to say that, you know, desistance is something more than non-offending. What we're talking about here is to emphasize the fact that getting people to desist and the study of the concept of desistance cannot suffice itself just by looking at non-offending. Okay, because from the very beginning, it became clear that the desisters were not reoffending because they, you know, they were not controlling their behavior because they feared more punishment. Bring it on. I don't care, right? They stopped offending for other reasons. So desistance is something more than non-offending. That's statement A. Okay, statement B is what religion brings to prison is a non-carceral response to offending. It seeks from the beginning to lift people up, to start from the beginning, to have a conversation, all in the context of, you know, in the example of Christianity, but not only Islam is the same, really. You can start from anywhere and recapture your life if you take personal responsibility and be accountable to the present. Okay, and that's very difficult work for people who have been abused, people who have, you know, I had an inmate describe for me how he had murdered his wife and shot her in the head and she fell down the steps in his arms. And we would sit in the chapel and he would literally just cry. And this guy wasn't even, by the way, part of our study. I would go to church when I was at Angola and we sat there. And he just described how coming to church, he said, I come here and I put it on the altar because it's the only thing I know to do. And so even with regard to that, that's a positive response. It doesn't have anything to do with reoffending. This guy's never going to get out of prison. Okay. But it's a positive force in the prison. Okay. that I think invites criminology and criminologists to expand their zombified discipline to include a conversation about how we might actually help people rather than just punish people. Because, you know, the doctrine of deterrence has kind of facilitated an academic complicity with mass incarceration, as far as I'm concerned at this point. And there are important racial differences between incarceration in the US and incarceration in Great Britain. In the United States, mass incarceration is much more heavily interwoven with the dynamics of race and race politics than in Great Britain. Although some of the same macro dynamics are present, America's two largest maximum security prisons in 2021 are still named after slave plantations, Angola and Darrington. We studied both of them for years. Okay, so we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of painful, difficult work to do, you know, and I Byron was joking with Byron at one point that economics is the dismal science. No, it's not. It's criminology. It really is. It's criminology because we have nothing positive to say. It seems to me at least, we have very little to offer in terms of positive direction and how to help people. And, you know, through Byron's especially leadership, this whole notion of pro-social behavior, right? We're not just interested in why you misbehaved and how we can control it, but what might we do? Why do people behave? Why do people behave themselves? Why do they volunteer? And I'm going to let Byron riff on this because he's the expert.
Well, you know, Michael, I wanted to follow up something you were saying about desistance. And Naomi and David, please forgive us that we're just rambling on and on without you cueing us. But
that's fine.
Okay. Well, I remembered when Michael was talking about a particular prisoner that I interviewed in the late 1990s. And his story was so dramatic. And he got out of prison, became a successful person in the eyes of the world when he got out. And he became so successful that he had a relapse at a dinner party. And no one knew about it, but he knew about it. And he felt terrible about it. He contacted his old colleagues in prison because they all looked up to him as this spiritual giant. And he said, you know, I relapsed and I just needed you all to know it. It wasn't like he had a hot drug screen and you got shipped back to prison. And he had to go tell everybody about this. And I just remember sitting there listening to him share his story. And he said, you know, my faith has helped me reconcile my past. You know, there was a time when I was in denial about my past. But I did do those things. And his path forward was, you know, I'm not happy with who I was, but I am happy about who I have become. And that is what will keep me on this path. And he didn't have any more relapses after that. And I think this is one of the powerful things and why religion fits the desistance approach so well. There's desistance without religion, but religion, I think, is a perfect variable to help us understand what it is that helps people walk away from an old life. And one of the things that we have found that has been really powerful in that whole desistance thing is the idea that faith requires me to pass on to others the blessings that I've received. And so this notion of caring for your neighbor, caring for your brother, is really powerful. And we've even applied this now to drug treatment. How do people stay sober? It's not just finding God, because they still relapse once they find God. But if they start giving their life away and helping other people that are struggling with addictions, they find their life. And that is the transformation. That's how they stay sober. Find God and give your life away. And that in kind of a nutshell, is what we have been finding in places like Angola and Parchman, another prison, Michael, named after a plantation that we are looking at. So this notion that I become other-minded instead of self-absorbed, which I think plagues especially the U.S., but not just the U.S. We're not the only country struggling with suicide and addiction. Other places around the world struggle too. And I think that's because people tend to internalize everything, look inside and medicate instead of seeking out help from others and then helping others themselves as they work through their own issues. And I think these are the powerful things about religion and transformation and desistance that kind of all coalesce together.
I think that was a really nice example of the guy who felt the need to share his relapse with the community. Because I think what you're touching on is with the concept of virtuousness, that idea of integrity as a person. And I think there has been the trend in treatment programs within the UK to talk about creating a new me, whereas I think certainly within the service that I worked in, we spoke about people connecting with their potential me, that they always have the potential to be. And I think that's what you're drawing on with your concept of virtuousness. And I wondered if you could explain, I mean, within your books you talk about prisons as a legal, painful or virtuous place. And I wonder if you could say, I really enjoyed the chapter on the virtuous behavior in prisons. And I wondered if you could talk more about those concepts.
Yeah, let me go first. And then Michael always cleans up after me, which is the way we work best. But I'll start with the virtue. I mean, people would think of prisons as the last place that you would think of as a laboratory for virtuous behavior. Because, many people, I remember, Michael, in grad school, they would talk about prisons as breeding grounds for criminal behavior. If you weren't, a well-rounded criminal, you will be by the time you leave, because you'll learn so many tricks of the trade. But one of the things that we have been finding as we look at prisoners and interview prisoners, we ask questions about humility. We ask questions about forgiveness. We ask questions about generosity and gratitude. More recently, we've been asking questions about accountability. And, we see these virtues as being critical ways of understanding identity transformation. And, your listeners probably won't be surprised to know that these things are all connected. That faith really does help people forgive. And it's really hard to, to start a new life if you can't forgive the people that have wronged you. And so many of these people they're suffering with post-traumatic stress. The majority of them are, because they've either experienced abuse or they certainly have observed abuse in their lives. So there's all this baggage that they have with them. And so that too is a real obstacle to rehabilitation. How do you rehabilitate people supposedly who have all this trauma that's never really been dealt with? And so in some of our newer research, we're trying to understand, does faith actually help people who are struggling with post-traumatic stress? And the early returns look quite favorable, that it does help people deal with that. And that, if you can help people deal with the trauma, then you can help people deal with these other kinds of things that have also been out of align in their lives. And so some of this is happening in prisons. You might think it's the last place where you would see it. And I think, along with the virtue that we're seeing, that prisons actually can model that, Naomi, we now think that it may well be that these prisoners can help us on the outside. As I mentioned earlier, we're struggling with an epidemic of suicide and, self-harm in the free world. And what can we learn from prisoners who have found a peace that seems to be so elusive for those of us that are not incarcerated? And I think that they would say that we do have something that we can offer too. And instead of us viewing, you know, these people as folks that need to be reformed, many of them could help us put our lives back together if we could look a little bit more closely at the transitions that so many of them have made. Michael, help me out.
Yeah, I mean, at Virtue, you know, I'm struck at this juncture by the role that Scripture plays as prisoners immerse themselves into these stories in the Christian book. Okay, they are repeatedly struck by how the narrative realism of Scripture for their lives. And I was in a prison in Michigan, and this guy says to me, once they become on fire, you can't get them to shut up, okay, about religion. But he says, listen, we're doing a study of 1 Kings. This is an Old Testament book about the transition of Israel after the death of David. It was a crazy, violent, conspiratorial gangster time. Okay. And this guy says to me, he says, man, that book is gangster. He says, I said, yeah, it sure is. And he says, you know, it's just like my life, betrayal, murder, double dealing. And I don't want that life anymore. And it seems to me that this is what, you know, what Byron is tapping into here. And that is that, especially with substance abuse, you know, 85 plus percent of people who end up incarcerated have substance abuse issues. And the whole 12 step, not going to go there, but, you know, that is a platform for this conversation. But this notion that, you know, other people can solve your problems for you is false. And if you read, you know, the narrative stories of pick one, any of David, Noah, Paul, Peter, just pick somebody. They all suffer. Solomon, they all suffer as a result of their own self-inflicted stupidity, self-inflicted wounds. Okay. And so, you know, this notion that you can't have other people solve your problems for you, the flip side of that coin is that you can't solve other people's problems for them. It has got to be participatory, right? And so to me, the beautiful thing about religious programming in prison is it's an invitation, right? It's with unconditional positive regard. It's an invitation for someone to embrace some very painful things, usually, because Byron's absolutely right. Almost always terrible things have happened to people who end up in prison, in my experience, especially if they committed a serious crime. And so, you know, it's a practice of, you know, I am the way, the truth, and the light. Okay. Follow me. There is a path out of this mess that you're in. And what we'll hear from prisoners is that what set me free is I realized I didn't have to leave prison to be free of prison. There's a seminary graduate at Parchman, who's a chaplain, who was an inmate at Angola. He graduated from the seminary and he's now, believe it or not, a chaplain in another maximum security prison, very dangerous prison. And they're taking these graduates of prison seminaries and putting them into prisons as chaplains because they have no problem negotiating the environment. And that's what they'll tell you. They'll say, listen, this environment may be challenging for other people, but it's really actually not that much of a challenge for me. And I can relate to people with unconditional positive regard in such a way and invite them into a conversation about their lives that almost no one else can have with them. The nice lady from the church can't have this conversation. And this guy's name is Sidney DeLoach. And he says, listen, Mike, nothing they tell me is going to make me flinch. I did 35 years at Angola. I've seen it all. You know, he spent his whole adult life in maximum security prison. And that kind of connectivity, that peer-to-peer kind of relationship where there's no judgment, is a critical piece of this. And there's a lot of great work in the United Kingdom going on the penal voluntary sector. That's got to be a piece of this, because we know in drug treatment, the most effective drug counselors are former addicts, right? And that's not a coincidence. And so what we're arguing for is a new movement, a whole redesign of the incarceration paradigm to what was in the United States, the Walnut Street Jail in its earliest days. It quickly deteriorated, but in its very earliest conceptualization, the Walnut Street Jail was basically a community corrections model. It was bring volunteers in, you can earn your way out. There are incentives for good behavior, not just disincentives. There's reward for good behavior, not just punishment for bad behavior. We need more reward for good behavior in the criminal justice system. People end up in there and they're trapped and destroyed and have no hope. And it's got to stop.
Perhaps you could, this is a good point for you to tell us more about the inmate peer ministry program. So I was really surprised to hear, A, about the, well, even that many of the officers, prison officers or guards, as you call them, have their own history of being incarcerated within American prisons. And then also this concept of the inmate peer ministry program, because I'm not aware of anything like that really happening within British prisons. And it seemed like it was happening on really quite a large scale. I wondered if you could say a bit more about it.
Well, Michael's much more of an authority, I think, on this. But I'll start us off by just saying that we do see that a big part of the next chapter of criminal justice reform will involve prisoners, period. I know that when we went to Angola to initiate that study, one of the things that we wanted to do was to go to church with the prisoners and sit in a church service and observe and take notes. And one of the things that we found was that the sermons were incredible. It's like, I've never heard a sermon like this before in my life. Very, very powerful, moving. And that's why, some of the correctional staff actually attended inmate-led churches. How's that for your listeners? Okay, so you work in a prison and you sit in a congregation led by prisoners. And that's why in Angola, now they very rarely have people from the outside who actually visit their pulpits. That's commonplace in a lot of prisons for people from the outside to come in and preach to prisoners. That doesn't happen really at Angola anymore. They have too many qualified preachers there that are so much better than anything that you could import to the prison. And so these peer ministries, as Michael was saying, there's something about the significance of a prisoner ministering to other prisoners that only they can do. There's something authentic about them that I don't know if you can match it in any other way. And so, we see these prisoners as assets that really we need to double down on these assets that we have and unleash them. But we have so many restrictions about what prisoners can or cannot do that we're actually hurting ourselves. So many states in the U.S. will not allow the kinds of things that we were observing in Angola, where these inmates are leading their own autonomous churches, where they're completely staffed by prisoners. This is not even possible in most states in the United States. And so here's this model that we think could be really transformative, but then you're going to have policies to change, which is something that Michael and I are working to see happen. The peer ministry thing is definitely what we think the wave of the future for reforming how our prisons work.
That's what really surprised me. And it's interesting to hear you say that happens in Angola, but wouldn't happen because the idea of that happening in Britain, I just think there's so much cynicism about people's motivations and intentions and such a lack of willing to trust in the incarcerated person's virtue or integrity that it's hard to see that taking off. So it's interesting to hear that's not everywhere in America.
Although it does, if I can say, that whole idea underlines or... You discover that in the whole therapeutic community movement, that liberation of people and enabling them to develop their own program and to run it.
Yeah, I mean, trust is earned, even though It's certainly true that there are prohibitions in many states against this sort of thing. It has to do with, you know, what I would argue is the failed state condition of American prison system. You know, that under normal, under what would, you know, in a normal Norwegian prison, you know, you could congregate inmates, no problem. But in the United States, we've got such overcrowded, dilapidated, deteriorated, understaffed prisons that, you know, that I always like to point out to my students two things. One, you know, they ask me, is there a perfect prison? I say, no, of course. Is it possible to have a perfect prison? Probably not. Are some prisons better run than others? Absolutely. Okay. So then it becomes a question of how best to manage and what resources, and it's a dramatically crazy situation in the United States because every state is radically different. You know, the other thing though, that I say is that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, at least faith-based programming is the tip of the iceberg of the kind of positive criminological work that needs to be done. We're not saying that faith will solve all our problems or that religious programming is some kind of panacea. We are saying in the midst of the overwhelming humanitarian crisis that is the American prison system, the only light that can be seen is, you know, by and large, oftentimes is in religious volunteers. But as a result of looking at that, I think we really do believe, and I'm convinced at least, that religion offers some very unique resources for people in prison that are very useful for self-reconceptualization, for self-forgiveness, for stress reduction, and for personal growth, that really does enhance this notion of virtue that you asked us about. It seems to me virtue is doing the right thing. Okay. And as Byron really put it well, you know, to me, that means being able to say, yeah, I did it. You know, I did it and I see it differently today than I did. I'm a different person today than I was. And you pick up any of the four Gospels and read three passages and you get basically the same story. You get basically the same story, Naomi, that I was this person. I'm born again. You know, the metaphors abound. And so on that level, religiosity provides prisoners a resource that they can use on their own terms, okay? And that is oftentimes relatable to them because of their past, whatever their church, you know, history was, in the midst of an otherwise very bleak context. So
you can see how that's appealing even to, I mean, obviously in Britain, the levels of religiosity are not as high as in America. But I do know of prisoners who've chosen to go and participate in religious ceremonies because they've enjoyed the atmosphere when they've been down there. They've enjoyed that sense of community and belonging. And I think the characteristics that you spoke of in terms of things like compassion and gratitude, generosity, all those sorts of things, which as you referred earlier, they're a light that people are drawn towards, aren't they? People enjoy that. And quite often in prisons, it seems like it can be hard to see some of these things. But you touched on something very, very briefly there where you spoke of religion kind of stepping into a vacuum in prisons. And I wondered whether the willingness of religion to step into these vacuums in prisons can make it easier for the state to evade its own responsibilities to citizens that are held in prison.
No doubt.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, that's, religion has become kind of a structural charity. You know, we raised the red flag about that at the end of both books, I think. And that, you know, religion, there does need to be more oversight, in my opinion. You know, like all forms of privatization, where you're outsourcing responsibility for care of inmates to a third party, faith-based programming, in my opinion, at least, are a funny kind of privatization, right? You know, there's no oversight. Prisons are in such dire straits that a lot of the programs have gotten well ahead of the science, you know, well ahead of the researchers. There's a lot more going on out there than we even know about, really, or can even hope to, you know, capture fully. And there are some church-state issues that are unresolved at this point, important, vexing in some ways, church-state issues. But at the same time, those are manageable, in my opinion, and especially given the alternative of nothing. The ACLU looked at the Angola Prison Seminary and decided, while there were civil liberties concerns, they paled in comparison to the impact of removing the seminary from the prison, for at least from a human rights perspective. Okay. So, you know, I would encourage people to keep an open mind. And I think we're at a turning point in our discipline of criminology. Hopefully, finally, lots of people, big people, Shad and Allison and others are arguing, listen, we need to wake up and try to deliver resources that people need and not just believe in the false hope that we are going to be able to punish our way out of the crime problem, because we're not.
Right. And, you know, along with that, Naomi and Dave, I know we're running out of time. You know, one of the things that Michael and I really are very serious about is continuing to do this research. Yes, there's not the oversight that's needed. And a lot of these groups that are doing work in prisons need to know if in fact they're effective. They have these programs. Some of them have multiple programs. I remember doing a study many years ago for Prison Fellowship, and they had three programs they wanted me to evaluate. And I found that two of the programs had no effect at all, but one was really effective. And so my message was, you should get rid of these two programs and really double down on this one that's effective. And so I think we do need research to help us understand what is working and what isn't, both faith-based and otherwise. And, you know, could it be that we might learn something from our studies of faith-based programs that can help the prisons more generally, or other approaches that are not faith-based? What might they glean from the research that we would do? So for us, we really are compelled to do this kind of work. We want to continue to do it because we think that it can help the system, and ultimately that we can, serve the least of these better than we are right now, for sure.
Well, I agree with what you said. I think there is a lot to learn. And I suppose I regretted not having read your books earlier, actually. And part of, the reason why the issue about virtuousness appealed to me was I'd quite often have conversations in groups that I ran with men about managing to hold on to their integrity as people or recapture that and live out with this, with the spirit of integrity, and what a difference that makes then to actions and how you live out your future. But I never wrote that formally into our treatment program, because to me that was just an idiosyncratic part of the discussion. But having had this, read your books and had this conversation today, were I in the position to be writing a treatment program again, I would absolutely feel it be important to be capturing something of that integrity or virtuousness as a way of enabling people to be aspiring to something positive and that's pro-social and enhances the strengths that they have. But I'm conscious of the time, and David, where are we? Are there questions that you wanted to ask that we haven't asked? Or
not really, because Byron and Michael have been answering the questions before we get to them.
We rambled on and on.
But I did just want to mention, although you touched on this a moment ago, yeah, Byron, because you'll be aware of the great What Works debate, which was sparked off by Robert Martinson's paper 40-odd years ago, which had such a destructive effect upon positive work in the States and certainly in the UK as well. So the question is, how are these programs being monitored, and what can you do to ensure that there is a kind of good standard and quality of effectiveness?
Yeah, well, thank you for that great question, David. I think Martinson's work in, I think, 1974, when that study came out, did really resonate, unfortunately, with so many people that believed nothing could work. And the reality is, we know people can be helped, people can change. We have evidence of that. We need more evidence of it. And so we want to keep doing this kind of research. We're involved in some research now in South Africa and in Latin America, Colombia, where we're looking at faith-based programs there. And, you know, what we're finding early on is some of the same things that we're finding in the States. And I'm sure we would find them in the UK. And that is that these programs really do help people improve their situation. And these prisons that we're studying, are the conditions are so much worse than the conditions here, as bad as they are here in the States. And so I think that there is hope. But we certainly need to know a lot more than we know right now. And so we are eager to continue to do this research and continue to seek the funding that we need to get to do this research. Regrettably, the government has not been particularly interested. So most of the research that we do has been privately funded. And I think that's regrettable in that the government, I think, has a keen interest in knowing what's effective and what isn't. I think that when it comes to religion, they get cold feet. So I think that we would like to see that change. So they evaluate a number of things, but the faith-based stuff has been understudied, and we're trying to at least make up for lost time with our work.
Yeah, I mean, if people are, you know, curious or question the notion that people can change, think of yourself as an adolescent. Are you different now than you were then? Have you evolved? Have you changed? Probably yes, right? There's the whole line of research in criminology called developmental theory. This is all anchored in developmental theory and belief in the notion that an armed robbery committed by a 14-year-old versus an armed robbery committed by that same individual at 47 years old is a different crime. Okay? In other words, you respond to an armed robbery of a 14-year-old differently than you respond to an armed robbery of a 47-year-old, even if it's the same individual. Okay? Why? Because people evolve. People are different. People do change. And it seems to me zombie criminology wants no conversation about that, by and large. They believe that an armed robbery is an armed robbery and a UCR index crime is an index crime and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's, as Jock Young used to say, that's not criminology, right? That's not what we're supposed to be about. We're supposed to be about making people better, making society better, and standing up for not just rampant brutalism, right? Which is what we've got now. And it's truly sad where we are. It really is.
Well, it may be sad, but you've brought some really rich material today. And I think it would be particularly interesting to establish a debate between you guys and some criminologists so that we can tease out some of these kind of issues that you're raising. That would be fascinating. So I also want to mention, because we've talked about Angola a lot, which is a famous or infamous name, really. And I know it mainly through the work of a singer called James Booker. James Booker and his song Junko Partner. He was a terrific pianist and blues singer who spent some time in Angola, but sadly died quite a number of years ago now, at the very young age of 40 something, in his 40s. A great song if people get a chance to listen to it. Finally, do you have any advice, your own experience, to help others keep psychologically healthy?
Wow.
I must say that my research colleague, Joshua Hayes, you know, after a couple of weeks at Angola, we would get home and our wives would say, "And you're in a foul mood," you know, and I was. And it does. There is such a thing as institutionalization. There's no question about that. I think having good colleagues, I was so grateful. And I know Josh was too, that I had someone there with me to commiserate with. Especially during these hundreds of hours of interviews, you know, life history interviews is the method that we used. And inevitably you get into the abuse histories of prisoners, that, in other words, how they were abused. I mean, time and time again. And we had their file. We could see their jacket, that this was absolutely authentic. There was one guy who in his pre-sentence investigation had a photograph. We saw it where he had been beaten back black and blue with a 2x4 as like a 13-year-old. And there you could see him in the file, bare butt, you know, naked in the picture, black and blue up and down, heel to neck. And he was describing that. You know, other sex offenders, and you know, if you're in Angola, you either killed someone or committed a sex crime, pretty much. And, you know, lots of sex offenders would describe their own sex abuse history. In other words, one guy said, you know, look, there were no boundaries at my house. It was cousins, friends, parents, you know. And so I have boundary issues, but I didn't know the boundaries, you know. And then he, of course, got life in prison for sex crime of a child. So these things are all terribly intermixed. And a lot of people end up in prison with no hope whatsoever. And religion, I'm convinced religion can provide and does provide hope on a level that no other resource can provide.
I enjoy a recent conversation we had, which was with a philosopher about hope, Kimberly Brownlee, talking about hope standards for prison. And that was a really rich conversation.
And you, Byron, how do you look after yourself?
Oh, well, you know, as I said at the very outset, you know, raised a religious person, I've always been a religious person. And, you know, I start my day off every day with a devotional, just to remind me of, you know, who I am, and why and how faith is important to me, and how blessed I am. So that's how I start each and every day. You know, I'm just really grateful that we've had a chance to be able to hear the stories that we've heard. You are affected when you come back and you've seen so much that's dark. But at the same time, hearing these powerful stories of inmates has really, I think, been transformative for us. It's really naive to say that we're value-free researchers and we're not affected by our own biases, or we're not affected by the stories that we hear. We have been affected by it, oftentimes in a real powerful way. And to kind of give voice to those that haven't had a voice is something that we feel honored to be able to do, David. And so, you know, we're on our own spiritual journeys. And I think the prisoners have played a huge role in our own lives. For that, we are incredibly grateful. And we hope that by sharing their stories, others will benefit as well, way beyond the prisons themselves. I mean, the inmates have told us for years that the next great awakening will come from the prisons. I'm not gonna doubt that might be true.
Thank you. It's been a brilliant conversation and great to hear such radical and progressive ideas being proposed as well during the course of it. So thanks very much.
Thank you both. We really enjoyed it.
That was a very powerful conversation. They've got some really interesting ideas and challenging to the field of criminology and, I suspect, psychology in its broadest sense as well. It would be, I think, interesting to see how we can continue this debate in some way.
Absolutely. It definitely felt like there was a conversation that could have gone on a lot further, because they were so full of life and thoughts and reflections on their work that they didn't really need questions from us in order to be able to produce those valuable insights. But also, I was genuinely stunned by, you know, I think people make assumptions about religion and assume that it's good to be conservative, and actually they were very radical, I thought, in their proposals and ideas. And I think that's a side of religion that doesn't really get focused on amongst criminology and psychology, like you say.
That's right. I think it's a very complicated picture, isn't it?
Mm.